Are you sweating?
I'm always sweating.
This is Bourbon Pursuit, the official podcast of bourbon, bringing to you the best in news, reviews, and interviews with people making the bourbon whiskey industry happen. And I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Coleman. You hear us talk all the time on the show about dusty bourbon, and we keep beating that dead horse because it's really a chance to drink history and have a completely different whiskey than what you can get in the bottle today on your retail shelves. In vintage spirits, they're on the rise, and they have gone from an underground, enthusiast-only kind of crowd and now making its way into the mainstream. And Aaron Goldfarb, he's a distinguished author, and he joins the show to talk about his new book titled Dusty Booze. And this book has a storyline with finding a dusty gold mine, but it goes into the story of decanters, minis, the hunt for rare bottles, and so much more. It's now available on Amazon and lots of different outlets. Go get your copy today. But with that, enjoy this week's episode. And now here's Fred Minnick with Above the Char.
I'm Fred Minnick, and this is Above the Char. This week's idea comes from Jason Ward, who writes me on fredminnick.com. Jason wants to know, what is the nickname for bourbons with malted barley as the most prominent secondary grain? So we know about the wheated bourbons where wheat is the secondary grain. It's the highest grain after the corn. And we know about high rye, which is the highest secondary grain when rye is used at a high amount. And he's wanting to know, well, what about barley? I happen to like the taste of barley in bourbon. You know, Jason, you actually have opened up a great conversation to have about how malted barley is sort of like this neglected, really not talked about grain in bourbon. Now, I want to take you back to early in my career. I think this might have been 2007, 2008. I was interviewing the great Jim Rutledge, then the master distiller for Four Roses. Of course, they're high rye bourbon territory. He was telling me at that time, you know, we don't really give enough love to malted barley. We should give more love to malted barley. And he was going on and telling me about how the industry has always looked as malted barley as just a means of creating fermentation because it helps enact fermentation. And he just would go on and on about how he really is very choosy about the malted barley he uses. And I kind of tabled that away. And then a couple of years later, I was listening to another distiller talk about how malted barley does not matter in bourbon. And then I heard another distiller talk about it, and another. And so I think that's right there is why, Jason, we don't actually have a nickname for those high malted barley bourbons, is because, let's face it, they've been neglected in the bourbon community. And if you don't have like the stalwart bourbon distillers coming out and talking about the grain, the consumers won't either. So if Jimmy Russell's not out there talking about it, then consumers aren't going to be talking about it. So it's up to us, Jason. It's up to us to create a nickname for the high malt bourbons. Hey, maybe that's it. High malt. Hey, that's a high malt bourbon you got there. You know what? I like that, Jason. Do you agree? Do you like high malt? Could it be high malter? Could it be maltster? You know, a new riff actually has a brand out there called Maltster. I like Maltster too. But I think I'm going to lean toward high malt, Jason. If you like high malt bourbons, hit me up on Twitter. Same with Bourbon Pursuit. Let us know what you think of the nickname. Is it high malt? Is it maltster? Is there a better nickname out there like wheated or high rye or wheater we could apply to those bourbons with high malt contents? Great question, Jason. If you want to be like Jason Ward, hit me up on fredminnick.com. Click the contact button. Shoot me your idea for Above the Char, and if I like it, I'll read it on the air. Till next week, cheers.
It's that time of the year where everybody's starting to make their vacation plans on visiting Kentucky, the mecca of bourbon. And if you are coming to Kentucky, you need to make sure you visit us at Pursuit Spirits in Louisville. We're right in the heart of Clifton, near Butchertown and Nulu, and only just a few miles away from downtown Louisville. But when you do come, you need to book your experience to go do our whole shebang. This is the one that's really the star of the show. You get a full-on tasting. You get to do your own personal barrel selection experience. And You get to grab a whiskey thief and fill your bottle directly from the barrel. We're doing something completely brand new that nobody else is doing here in bourbon country. Plus, you get a free sweet tasting glass at the end of it. I guarantee you, you're going to end up being one of the many people that's also leaving us a 5-star review. So make sure you come and check us out. You can book your reservation by going to pursuitspirits.com and clicking the Visit Us button.
It's that time again to get bourbon strong with Give270. Purchase your $50 tickets for your chance to win from our 50 bourbon prizes. Don't miss out on rare bottles and grand prizes like the legendary Pappy Set, a Weller Rainbow, and the Blood Oath Trilogy. Hurry, only 3,000 tickets are available. Single bottle winners go back in for the grand prize draw. Will you win the ultimate Pappy Set or one of our other incredible prizes? Get your tickets now at Give270.org. Charitable gaming license ORG 0002703.
From their bar to yours, Chad and Sarah of the popular YouTube channel It's Bourbon Night bring you their favorite at-home old-fashioned mix with the new Elemental Elixirs Golden Hour Syrup. It's a custom-made syrup with notes of bold black tea, warm spices, and orange zest. All you need is your favorite whiskey and ice. No bitters needed. One bottle makes 16 drinks, so that's only $1 cocktail before you add your own whiskey. They can also be enjoyed in other cocktails or spirits, mocktails, coffee, tea, and anything you can think of. It's crafted locally in Lexington, Kentucky, and you can get your bottle now at whiskeyambitions.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Bourbon Pursuit, the official podcast of bourbon. Kenny and Ryan here today. How's Ryan?
I'm here.
Hey.
I'm Ryan.
Actually,
I'm supposed to introduce myself, right?
You really need to nowadays. Nobody really knows who you are.
Yeah. So I'm Ryan.
No, I'm just kidding. Everybody knows who you are. But this is going to be a fun conversation. You know, on the past episodes, we actually have talked about dusties and dusty hunting at one point. We had Larry Rice from Silver Dollar, talked about some of his epic hunting stories.
I had Bill Thomas. Jack Robert.
Yep. Jack Rose. We've had the Justin Sloan on from Justin's House of Bourbon. And to kind of just talk about the allure of it. But we never had anybody on the show that talk about this from like soup to nuts that actually wrote an entire book about dusty hunting and dusty booze and everything like that. But I'm really enjoying to get into this. Not only that, is he's been a friend of the show. He's been a past guest and a renowned author in the drink space as well. So I'm really excited to kind of dig into more of our topic and our guest today as well.
Yeah. I'm trying to think back the first time I had a dusty bottle. The most memorable one had to be us at like whiskey. It was Whiskey Pig at the Kentucky Bourbon Festival, and Bill Thomas rolls out all these like beautiful old granddads, Chessmans, you name it, Goldfoil turkeys. And you'd always seen these balls, but you never had them. And then you try them, and then you're like, oh my God. And then it's just like a light bulb moment. You're like, I got to go find as many of these as possible. And then I go on this estate sale like addiction, trying to find old basements that have been cleaned out, trying to find old bottles for a good price. And yeah, there's just this like nostalgic romanticism, but also the whiskey is amazing. And I love Aaron's previous book, Brand Mysticism, was like, I think I read it in like 2 to 3 nights because I was so like entrenched. It was so well written, and we haven't read this book, but I'm excited to dive into it.
Yeah, we'll definitely get into it. So today on the show, he's been a past guest on episode 418 where we talked about brand mysticism. He was also a bonus guest that we had during the COVID era days when we were just pumping out extra content because we had time to do it. So welcome back to the show, Aaron Goldfarb, the author of his latest book release called Dusty Booze.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I certainly used many of your previous episodes to do my own research for the book. So thanks for that free research.
Help me. Oh, go on. Tell me more about that.
Tell us
well,
more.
You know, the great thing is if you're a writer and certain people don't want to talk to you, you can just go, well, luckily you've already recorded a 2-hour podcast with the Bourbon Pursuit guys, so I can get all your, I can listen to it at 1.5 speed and get all your thoughts about the industry right there.
Do we have an annotation in the book? You know,
I sure hope so.
Yeah, I'm kidding. We don't need one.
No, that's awesome. I guess give folks a background if they're just now knowing and hearing of Aaron Goldfarb and some of the books and stuff you've done. Give people a little bit of your history too.
I've been a drinks fan since I was old enough to almost legally drink, and I've been writing about drinks for probably the last 15 years, craft beer industry, whiskey, cocktails, you name it. If you can drink it or you can sit in a place and drink there, I've probably written about it and it interests me very much. I write feature stories for places big and small, New York Times, Esquire, Wall Street Journal, places more niche like Vine Pair, where I'm writer at large. And then I've written quite a few booze industry books over the years. Hacking Whiskey is a popular one that a lot of people in the whiskey business have. Brand Mysticism, as you said, I wrote that with Steve Grass, the creator of Hendrick's Gin, and countless other brands that you're probably not even aware. He created almost everything interesting of the last 20 years.
Sailor Jerry.
Yeah. He brought Narragansett Lager back. He made High Life cool again. He's just a real branding maven. He's lived a very colorful life and has lots of colorful ideas. And I put his thoughts and words into Brand Mysticism. And my latest book is Dusty Booze, as you said.
So I guess give us the premise of what made you want to even write a book on Dusty Booze, other than the fact that it tastes delicious. And there's probably a lot of people that listen to the podcast now that are very, what we'd say, kind of like the modern day bourbon consumer, where yeah. They got into this in the past like 3-4 years versus like when we got into it, getting access to Dusty's probably wasn't as hard as it is now. So give your sort of attraction with it and why you wanted to do this.
Yeah, I remember the first time I heard about the word Dusty hunting. It was like 2012 or so. And this guy told me he'd drive around Los Angeles all day going to liquor stores and looking for old stuff that had been on the shelves for 20 or 30 years. And I said, well, why in the world would you want to do that? Well, old granddad used to be made by a distillery that wasn't Jim Beam called National Distillers. And old granddad is vastly superior to today's stuff. You like Pappy? Well, that originally was Stitzel Weller liquid that has not been on the shelves since 1992. If you go to enough liquor stores, maybe you'll find an old Fitzgerald or a Weller from then, and you can taste kind of Pappy before it was Pappy. Lots of single malt scotches that went out of a business like Port Ellen's, a very cult one. You could find that on shelves. And there was a real glory time in the late aughts and early 2010s where these people savvy enough to know what to look for were just absolutely clearing out America of these incredible bottles that might still have $2 price tags on them. So by 2012 or 2013, I figured, the jig is already up. Why waste my time? But if I'd started Dusty hunting then, I think I would have done pretty well. I just figured it was already up. Obviously, it's pretty much up by now, although there's some stories in my book about people that are still making amazing scores. Over the last 10 years, I've just covered why old spirits matter, why they taste interesting and good, what they can teach us about the past, not just in bourbon, but in all industries, rum, tequila, liqueurs. And then in 2020, a big time Dusty hunter, Kevin Langdon Ackerman, came to me and he said, I found director Cecil B. DeMille's booze collection from the 40s north of Los Angeles. And I wrote about that for the New York Times. And that story did quite well. And publishers started reaching out to me going, can you expand this into a book? And I'm a freelance writer who always needs to make a buck. So I said, yes, of course I can. And then I sat around going, no, can I? But luckily, Kevin had a story bigger than Cecil B. DeMille for me to pursue. And that's what the book is about.
So it is about Kevin for the most part. Is that what a lot of this is?
The through line of the book is Kevin's search for Howard Hughes's liquor collection. Howard Hughes died in 1976. And the belief was that his offices on 7000 Romaine in Los Angeles in Hollywood were sealed off. The new owners took over the building and for whatever reason never reopened Howard Hughes's offices. So in that single office where Howard Hughes once was one of the world's greatest entrepreneurs, there was his golf clubs, his dinner jackets, his cameras, and his bar cart with an amazing collection of booze. And that thinking proved to be true, which you'll discover by the end of the book. I won't completely spoil it, but I do eventually get to drink Howard Hughes's Old Forester from 1946, which was pricey and delicious. So that's the through line of the book. And then it goes in and out with other big names in the industry, collectors, people that have opened up bars in your town, of course, and throughout America. And as I said, why these spirits might matter and why you might want to drink an old tequila, for instance.
Yeah, I actually just pulled up the book here on a PDF and it was, you actually just kind of checked out some of the names. So I saw like Owen Powell of Need and Brad Bonds of Revival Vintage Spirits and stuff like that. So I'm sure that's the modern day era. But I guess the I don't want to give everything away in the book, absolutely. But I kind of want to set the little bit of a historical context here to it. So like the first chapter, you talk about the glut era. It mentions decanters, chessmen, King Tut, which was the old Michter's bottle. And then what it says also the king. What's considered the king? Is that the king of Kentucky back then, or is that something completely different?
Well, I'm sure a lot of people have seen the beautiful King Tut Michter's decanter from, I think it's 1978 or 1979, whenever King Tut was getting paraded around America. This was made, not the greatest liquid, really awesome thing to post on Instagram if you're drinking it at Neat or whatnot. The king is Elvis, and a distillery called McCormick's made a series of Elvis decanters, I guess during...
That was in Missouri, right?
Yeah, during the 70s. Again, not the most incredible liquid, but... Man, you can't beat dumping some bourbon out of the king's head, whether he's dressed in his Las Vegas jumpsuit or his Hawaii luau outfit when he performed at the Pearl Harbor Memorial. I think there was 30-something in all, and those have started gaining a collectability despite not being the most delicious liquid in the world.
Yeah. And so it talks about the glut era. And for people that we've talked about this, and potentially even the new modern potential glut era that we might see in the next few years, talk about the story that you saw form out of the glut era that time and like how it built Dusty Booze and the people that really chase after it today.
Yeah. I mean, anytime we're drinking a dusty spirit, we got to be grateful that someone from the past was not smart enough or tasteful enough to drink it back then. And a lot of Americans were not drinking bourbon in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. In fact, from I think 1970 or 71 on till about 1999, every single year bourbon went down in sales. Every single year. And bourbon is a industry completely different from vodka or gin or even maybe tequila, where what you're producing, you have to predict what human beings are going to want to drink in 4, 8, 12, 23 years from now. So a lot of these distillers went, well, sure, they're not, these hippies aren't drinking this right now in the 70s, the 60s, but I'm sure they're going to be drinking it by 1988. I'm sure they're going to be drinking it by 1985. And I even asked Eddie Russell, why were you continuing to make so much damn bourbon if no one was drinking it? And he said the exact same thing. Jimmy, his father, was certain that one day again, people would be drinking bourbon. And that's why so much great bourbon was still being made. It probably took a little longer than these men expected. They were proven right, of course. And bourbon became red hot by the 2000s and until today.
Yeah.
Yeah, you kind of see that in modern, as the generation like behind millennials, they say they're not drinking as much and there's like a big concern. But everybody's like, oh, they don't have kids yet. They don't have stress. Eventually, so you see a similar pattern forming there.
Yeah. I have two kids and I think you guys have kids too. So I'm doing my best to prevent another glut every night.
No doubt.
But it is funny that we're benefiting at the expense of that previous generation going through the downfall. Or
yeah, I mean, anytime you read a story about someone from the 70s drinking screwdrivers or tequila sunrises or fuzzy navels or whatever, you shouldn't make fun of them. You should thank them. Thank you for drinking peach schnapps instead of bourbon. I can drink it now.
Yeah, I didn't really put it in that perspective. And so, yeah, there was this huge glut of bourbon that was coming around. And then you kind of also talk about the secondary market. And I think that definitely plays a huge role into discovering a lot of these. My own personal opinion, I remember my first time getting into the original Facebook groups and people would be selling a $100 bottle of Old Granddad from 1970. And it had a price tag on it that said $7.99. And I'd think to myself, like, what moron is paying like 10x to be able to like try this stuff? It was like, but I had no idea. I was
one of those morons.
Well, yeah. a smart moron. It's probably worth 4 or 5 times x now.
Yeah, totally. And so I guess talk about a little bit, like, did you feel that the secondary market really contributed to the hype of Dusty's and really how they started taking over?
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know if it's a hype thing per se. It's more of like people like us have this collectability bug or sickness. And once you've got all the BTAC, once you've got all the Pappy, once you've got all the Four Roses, small batch, limited edition, you're running out of things to collect. So you have to look to the past instead of waiting another 365 days for more BTAC. That's what I presume happened. Once you've seen how easy it is to get some of the current allocated things, you start going, well, can I up the ante and try to find some Stitzel Weller from my birth year, some old granddad from the year my parents got married? What does this taste like? I know what all the current BTAC tastes like. What did this great stuff from the past taste like? What did pre-prohibition rye taste like? And so I think a lot of these early collectors cared less about the value and more about what do these things taste like? Why are they so great? And how great a deal can I get? That $10 old granddad from the 70s, incredible. There's nothing today that's $10 and would have tasted that good.
Yeah, and I think it totally helped like just expose it in general. Like I had no idea that old granddad was that good. You just always thought it was like bottom shelf, you know, crap. And so, but when you see it, you get in these groups. I remember I miss these so much. I miss the Facebook Strong Water Trading and all those ones where you just scroll and see the dusty bottles, but you're like, why does somebody care about that? And then you start digging in and researching more and talking to others. And so the secondary market just helped, I think, expose it to bourbon drinkers and collectors as well.
Yeah. And I think these old bottles are beautiful works of art from the past and really fun to have in your hand and in your house. And a lot of them haven't changed a lot. An old granddad from 1970 still has that iconic orange label with the cranky old man on it. So if you didn't look closely and didn't know what to look for, you could easily see why it would have sat in a liquor store for 30 years without anyone noticing, because it looks the same as it does today. Same with old Overholt. Same with a lot of these legendary heritage brands from the past. But they're wildly different. They were made by different people, different places, different production processes, and they taste quite a bit different, of course.
Yeah. Did you talk to any store owners? Like, why did you hold on to these bottles for 30 years? Why didn't you liquidate them or do something with them? And that's what's always fascinated me about it.
Yeah.
How do you just sit on inventory that long?
There's a clearance shelf usually at these places nowadays, and they have red tags on them.
Well, first of all, I'm stupefied. I never thought to do that, to say, hey, my friend bought about $50,000 worth of vintage from you that you sold him for $10. Well, how do you feel, sir?
That's true. Yeah, you don't want to rub it in.
But I was in Rome in 2019, and there was a bargain bin of Amaro, and I got a 1960s Montenegro for €1. So a lot of these store owners just thought, I cannot get rid of this damn stuff. Please take this 1970s old granddad off my hands. It's gathered so much dust. I can't dust it anymore. Please take it. I think a lot of store owners today are smart enough to Google things. But then again, you got to remember, in a lot of major cities, store owners are not American. They might not have a very strong grasp on the English language. They're just immigrant mom and pop shops, and they are just trying to make a living, and they might not even know who the fuck Pappy Van Winkle was and why we should care what he was making in 1935.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I guess the other thing you mentioned with the Elvis and the decanters, it kind of just jogged my memory a little bit, because it's funny, you see a lot of the Beam decanters that come out. You talked about the Michter's one too, and that was just like I don't know if you cover it in the book. The real reason why that was a ploy back then is because people weren't buying whiskey. Like, they had to figure out little tchotchkes and little ways that you could buy the whiskey, and they had to put it in some kind of really random different bottle.
Yeah. One of my favorite stories in the book, and I do have a whole section on decanters, is so Jim Beam was making an extraordinary amount of decanters. They would put it in anything. One of my favorites is that for some reason, they made a Vice President Spiro Agnew decanter, because everyone wants a drinkable vice president who's going to be charged with tax evasion eventually. They would make, you know, Corvette decanters and lawnmower decanters and every sports team you can think of. They're just trying to get people to buy it regardless of the liquid in there. 80 proof Jim Beam from the era. Sometimes good, sometimes blah. But there was a Jim Beam Decanters Collector Society that had yearly conventions. And my favorite thing is, I can't remember where it was. I think it was in Sacramento. Something like 20 or 30,000 people come to this collector's convention, and Jim Beam has to produce their own Jim Beam vodka, because that's what these decanter collectors want to drink. They don't want to drink any. They don't want to drink any of the bourbon they're collecting. They want to actually just drink vodka. So Jim Beam had to make a vodka, which, from what I understand, is a rare, very collectible vintage vodka, the Jim Beam convention vodka.
I had no idea. That's a pretty funny story. My gosh. You think of things that get uncovered like that, and it is a funny like relic of the past, because we do take it for granted. One of my funny stories was for my wedding, we had actually, my grandfather had passed away, and he had an old dusty bottle of Wild Turkey 101 8-year. And to be fair, this is way before I got into bourbon. So it was just kind of an homage that we were sitting there just taking shots of it. Like we didn't put enough care into that bottle as we should have. This goes back, like you didn't really know what you had back then. One of the things that I'm kind of curious about, and maybe you have it in the book as well, is the factors that you feel or that others feel about what really contributes to a dusty whiskey or dusty bourbon. And not only that, I see you talk about some dusty rum, dusty tequila, but what factors really come into play with these particular spirits and what makes them so different? We've heard everything from the types of grain, they were all non-GMO. The types of wood was used were more, had higher age, and they were their old growth trees. I don't think maybe one of the things that is probably the modern day thing is we should do is like drink a bottle now and then save a bottle for 50 years and see what happens. You don't know what happens with oxidation inside the bottle. Like, give me some of the examples of what other people thought of when they approached you, or kind of your own thoughts on this too.
Yeah, well, I am very grateful to Owen Powell, because I sent him an email and I said, why do you think old bourbon's better? And he essentially just emailed me back a chapter I could just add my name on and put into the book. So
it's like ChatGPT.
Yeah, it's like, well, thank you. With certain spirits, we know for a fact why they're better. Old tequila's better because the agave was more mature. Simple as that. Now they're pulling agave from the ground quite quickly. But bourbon, you know, is codified into law and must be made a certain way. So we can't say they were charring barrels different back then. There's very strict protocols, which is why vintage bourbon's so interesting. You mentioned some of the key factors. Was the corn better? Now corn's made purely for yield. I think a lot of people know the government subsidizes it. So government subsidized corn doesn't necessarily sound like the most tasty thing in the world. Oak trees older, again, as you said, back then, older oak trees, more rings, more places for bourbon to go in when the barrel's contracting and expanding. Entry proof, I think, is a big one for the nerds out there. 125's the highest you can legally put it into the barrel. The higher proof you put something into the barrel, the less barrels you have to use for a batch of bourbon. You water that 125 down to 100 proof or 110 proof, you're going to need more barrels. That's going to cost more money. That's going to take potentially longer to age the batch. But when the heat starts causing liquid to evaporate, water's going to evaporate first, not the bourbon. So if you taste a pre-fire Heaven Hill, and I can't remember what the entry proof was, I just marvel at how rich and textured the mouthfeel is despite it being 80 proof. You simply don't taste 80 proof bourbon today that doesn't taste watery, especially if you're a barrel proof drinker like a lot of us are. But you taste this old Heaven Hill from before 1996 when the fire was, and it's just so rich and flavorful and textured. And you go, wow, if 80 proof bourbon was this flavorful and textured right now, I would actually drink it. I wouldn't have to drink all the hazmat stuff to get a little excitement. So that's a big one. And yeah, we have to question whether bottle aging actually occurs. The famous line is that vintage bourbon is a liquid time capsule. You open a 1960s bourbon, you taste what a man in 1960s would have tasted. But at the same time, we know there's makers of eau de vie and other spirits in Europe that age in glass. And drinkers readily admit it calms down, it smooths out. Things happen when it's aging in glass. Now, not bottles, giant demijohns. So you have to ask yourself, is something happening? I don't know. I think it's a lot of these factors are going into it. Fermentation, Wild Turkey, Maker's Mark, and some others used to famously ferment in cypress tanks, not stainless steel. Now, they'll tell you that doesn't matter, but you have to think, was some yeast, was some signature microflora getting in there? Is that why the famous Wild Turkey funk, as a lot of people call it, exists in old Wild Turkey? Those are some of the key factors, I would say.
For my own probably intents and purposes, a lot of those are the same exact reasons that always come to my mind of thinking of what does contribute to the dusty bourbon. And there's just a different taste to it. You mentioned the Wild Turkey funk, but there is this weird funk going through when you're interviewing people. Did anybody
almost taste dusty?
I was going to say, did anybody come up with a better term of like what to call something like that other than just like the dusty funk?
If you're anything like me, then you can't get enough about bourbon. And that's why I'm a subscriber to Bourbon Plus magazine. Bourbon Plus is a quarterly publication that tells the stories from the heart of bourbon. The farmers who grow the grain, the distillers who labor over the process, and the people, like you and me, who raise their glasses to celebrate it all. Subscribe to Bourbon Plus magazine today at bourbonplus.com, that's P-L-U-S.com, and use code PURSUIT at checkout for $5 off your subscription. Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point-of-sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. And with Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. And you can get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/bourbon, all lowercase, and go to shopify.com/bourbon to take your retail business to the next level today. Shopify.com/bourbon.
Did anybody come up with a better term of like what to call something like that other than just like the dusty funk?
No, they didn't. And I think another factor in vintage spirits is your own memory and romance, as you said, just thinking about something old. Maybe you start thinking of other things that are old, library books, leather. There's something very soothing and romantic and powerful about drinking something old. And I don't discount that plays into the so-called funk as well.
Another thing, you know, we talk about the collecting side of things. I know a lot of people. There's actually another listener of ours lives down in Florida. He's a good friend of ours as well. And he collects mini dusties.
Yeah.
And I know there was a huge market for that at one point of, I don't know, and maybe you can explain maybe why there was a big market for it. Today, you go to Total Wine, you go to some of the larger stores, you see some minis, what some people might call like airplane bottles, but it's not like every brand has one. And it's a very select few, but it felt like back then, there was just a lot more choice, or maybe that was the preferred way to consume it. Is there anything that you kind of know from that?
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. Almost, if any bourbon brands make minis these days, it's their most mid-level flagship. There's no, well, Blanton's makes minis, not that those are seen anywhere, but for the most part, there aren't Pappy minis. I don't believe there are Weller minis. There's not a Master's Keep mini or whatnot. But you're right, back in the 60s, it seems every single thing they made also came in mini. But back then, there were also like 30 different sizes of bottles, flasks, gallons.
The cradles.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know if they hadn't had accountants come and say, we really only need like 5 sizes that should satisfy the entire consumer base. We don't need to make 35 sizes just because one guy wants to buy minis and another guy likes to have a gallon swing of old granddad in his house. So I don't actually know, but anecdotally, you're absolutely right. There was a ton more choice in miniatures back in the day. Scotch-wise, I do know why. Because some of them were so expensive, it gave the customers a chance to both sample them and get single malt at a cheaper price.
That definitely makes sense. I mean, I don't know. It's just a different way to think of like how the consumer was, I don't know, how they purchased back then. Because yeah, you're right. You just don't see that. Going through the book, did you see people that were just like strictly collecting dusty minis?
Sure.
Or is there something that was is there a reason why there's a fascination in that versus getting full bottles? And
yeah, absolutely. One of the biggest mini collectors in the world, maybe the biggest, is this Israeli guy. And I wrote a story on him for Punch. If you Google Aaron Goldfarb Israeli guy minis, but he has like 30,000 minis. He thinks it's a cooler way to collect. He says, if I have lots of big bottles, it looks like a bar. If I have lots of little minis lined up in his custom built glass case he has in whatever room in his house his wife allows him to do this, it looks like a collection. So he collects minis. Lots of people do collect minis. Lots of people collect pretty much anything you can think of in the spirits world. There's someone who collects that one specific thing that's got down to the smallest gradient of this is the one thing I collect. And there's certainly many collectors, and they have mini conventions and they trade minis. Certainly cheaper to ship.
Yeah, I would say a little bit easier to ship, less breakage to worry about. Yeah, there's a lot of those things that kind of play in.
Bigger fear of oxidation, though.
Just because of the amount and how long it's sitting there?
Well, anyone who's seen a mini bottle knows that the caps are pretty terrible. They're usually just cheap metal caps. The less liquid, again, the better chance it's going to get oxidized. That's why a lot of wine drinkers like Magnums, because the incredible amount of volume just can fight off oxidization better. Ditto with spirits. The smaller the bottle, the better chance it can evaporate and get oxidized.
Yeah, that makes sense too. I also kind of want to tie into the storyline a little bit. So talk me a little bit through. So Kevin's on the hunt, comes across this gold mine, if you will, of dusty booze. Talk about, if you can, were there legal ramifications of acquiring it? Was there anything that was like really a bunch of hurdles that could overcome it other than making sure you have enough money?
Well, cash is king in the dusty business for sure, especially for the IRS. Kevin actually does not quite end up finding the collection. Minor spoiler alert. As far as I know, it sits at Howard Hughes' office from 1976 till I think about 2020, right around the pandemic. And then a new owner of the building takes over and decides to take the entire office to auction. And an auctioneer comes to Howard Hughes' office, maybe for the first time since 1976, and he's giddy. There's Howard Hughes' old stuff from when he owned TWA, the airlines. There's his golf clubs. There's his golf shoes. There's these cameras. He was one of the early pioneers in the film industry. All this stuff the auctioneer thinks is going to go for crazy prices. And he takes the bar cart as a toss-in. Why not? I'll take that as well. Howard Hughes' liquor ends up going for the second highest price of any of the Howard Hughes' lots, more than his golf clubs, more than his aviation goggles, more than anything else. And the auctioneer was shocked. He hadn't even known vintage spirits were a thing, much less vintage spirits attached to such a celebrity. So they end up being acquired by this bar owner in Seattle, whose name is Matthew Powell. He's a doctor and he owns a bar called The Doctor's Office, which is a 12-seat tasting room cocktail bar and has quite a vintage spirits collection. So I eventually head out to Seattle to sit with Howard Hughes' liquor and taste it.
I would imagine as somebody that is doing the auction, they probably are. They're dumbfounded. They're just like, what the hell just happened right now? Do you remember what the dollar amount that it went for in the auction?
Honestly, so the collection didn't end up being quite as big as was thought. I think it's about 90 bottles. And the thing was, so there a lot of dusty hunters monitor all the auction markets, and there's a lot of big ones. But this didn't go up on a booze auction market. It went up on a Hollywood auction market. I forget what it's called. So Kevin just so happens to also be a Hollywood memorabilia collector. So he might have been the only dusty hunter that was also aware of this auction. So your typical booze buyers were not aware of this auction. And I don't know how Dr. Powell found it. I think just random Googling came across. But it didn't go for as much as you might think. I think it went for about $6,000. I think if it had gone to a full auction on like Whiskey Auctioneer or something, it would have gone for a lot more. So I think he made a great deal and got a pretty nice little collection.
Yeah, I was about to say.
Yeah.
Anytime you can win a bottle in auction, you feel good about it. I think it's a good deal. I've had a few of those. I remember getting a few dusties on unicorn auctions before literally people like knew about it. And I was snatching up stuff from the 50s for like less than $100 or maybe $100-$150 a bottle. And I was like, this is a gold mine. I hope this keeps going. And then all of a sudden, like a couple weeks later, that got kibosh. Everybody else found out about it. That's for
yeah.
sure.
My least favorite thing to do is to go to these auction sites and say, search for whatever, Old Fitzgerald, Old Granddad. Oh, a bottle sold in 2018 for $50? Come on, man. How could I not? Not a chance these days, but kind of cruel how they keep the archives and let you know how cheap things were going for in the past.
Oh, I know.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what price it would have if you had the right buyers there that weren't looking for memorabilia. They were looking for dusty booze.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can tell you, you know, he's selling Old Forester 1946 at, I think, $200 an ounce right now. So he's quickly getting his money back.
Hashtag winning.
Yeah, there you go. We had mentioned Owen Powell, who owns the bar Neat in Louisville. Brad Bonds, that owns Revival Vintage Spirits, which is in Covington, Kentucky. And that's all done because we have a Vintage Spirits Act here in Louisville or in Kentucky that allows us to do that. But you had mentioned a few other places. And yes, we're not treading new ground here. There's other places in California and New York and stuff like that that have been able to have vintage spirits in their portfolio for a while. The interesting thing is, how many bar owners did you talk to about maybe like running a business on this throughout the book? And did they have a different take on it versus the actual hunters?
I've talked to most all of them, if not for the book, for stories in the past. There's really only, I don't know, there's under 20 like major vintage bars, but more happening every day. So yeah, I certainly used to say to people like Owen or Brad, like, seems risky to build an entire business on a non-renewable resource, but they convinced me otherwise. What we're drinking today will be vintage in 20 years. And I sit around and go, every fine restaurant in America has vintage wine. So I actually think there's a huge market for vintage bourbon, vintage spirits that's untapped. And I think these places can keep loading up. Cannon in Seattle's had 178-page menu of vintage spirits for almost a decade. If they start selling too fast, raise the price a little bit and keep your library in stock. But yeah, it does seem like a scary thing to base your business on vintage, but all these places seem to be doing great.
It's interesting you bring up the bourbon today will be vintage someday. And it's like, well, how many years does it have to be in existence to be considered a vintage or dusty? I know what the law says, but to like a serious buyer or
yeah.
a serious
I mean, I think the law in Kentucky
person.
Is 1 year and the law in, I think, North Carolina is 20 years. I always say to people like, yes, your 2020 Wild Turkey is a vintage spirit, just not a particularly exciting one. I agree with Kentucky. Anything older than a year is a vintage spirit, just perhaps not a particularly exciting vintage spirit. I don't know. Are people in 2050 going to be excited by the 2024 spirits we're drinking today? I don't know. And I also question whether enough production processes are changing and things are changing that people in 2050 are going to look back and go, wow, in 2024, what were they doing to make these taste so great? Or if the stainless steel, the computer-driven distilleries, the incredible labs run by MIT microbiologists mean that bourbon is just going to be consistently great and taste like this for the rest of time. I really don't know. It's an interesting question.
We'll look back on the bottles we're trying now and in 20 years and be like, oh, we had it so good back then, but who knows?
One thing for sure, they'll be able to easily identify them moving forward.
Right, that's right. They're not going to have to know how to do weird Julian code reading. Yeah,
that's exactly very true. That are reading underneath the bottles, looking at the bottle date codes or tax strips. Talk about that too, about dating. Because I know there's something that if people that don't know, there's a lot of stuff out there. There's some good resources to know that if you are looking for a vintage spirit and you get something with a tax strip, there's websites that are dedicated that show you like these are the years that it was produced and whatnot. Was there any of that kind of information going on in the book, or at least you talk from people that were in the hunting days?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not one of those encyclopedias that can tell you every DSP number that's ever existed. A DSP number just tells you where something was distilled and every bourbon has that on it. I certainly think we lost something with tax stamps being taken away. Those existed, I think, from post-prohibition till 1981. Most of them tell you both distillation year and bottling year. Quite handy. It's a little trickier these days, but UPC codes, if you know how to read UPC codes, again, there's lots of resources on the internet and in some in my book as well to let you know, well, this old granddad's from National Distillers, not Beam Suntory. The DSP is a big one for letting you know where something was distilled.
Yeah, for, I guess, some tips that are out there. So if you come across, I think it was 86259? Is that the UPC for it?
I can't recall.
Okay.
I believe the DSP of the old Granddad Distillery was 14, though.
Yeah, and I think it was the UPC is 86259.
Okay.
And then, yeah, it's like if you're looking for Heaven Hill, you got to look for DSPKY, what, 31 or something like that?
31.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So there's all these other kind of tricks and tools of when you're looking around. And in your opinion, I'd love to get your idea about this. I felt like at least a few years ago, the way that you felt back in 2012 and thinking like, this is done, like, especially in 24, there's no way, there's absolutely no way that there's a store left on the face of this planet that might even have some dusty bourbon on it. Give me your thoughts.
Well, I don't want to completely spoil this story, but there's a story in the book about a guy, a dusty hunter, who doesn't just find a store with a few old bottles. He finds an entire store that's been sealed and shut since 2005 and buys the entire store.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, wow.
An entire store.
He buys the entire store and all its contents.
You're going to have to read the book, kid.
Yeah, I know.
That's one of my favorite stories.
Okay.
That's an amazing
story. But no, you're right. Afterwards. Collectors have had to find new routes for finding this stuff, whether it's going to estate sales, as you said, maybe reading the obituary, seeing if any former secretaries at Buffalo Trace have passed away, what's in grandpa's attic. People like Owen Powell tell me there's a Kentuckian who dies every single day who has a massive collection that needs to go to market. So he feels pretty confident that old bottles are constantly going to be coming to shelves. I mean, even in New York, you constantly hear stories about a new homeowner buys an old home from the 20s or whatever, and the cellar's full of pre-prohibition whiskey.
Yeah.
Ironically, I just had a text yesterday that someone moved into a new office and they opened up the liquor one of the cabinets, and there was 10 old Fitz bottles and some Ancient Ages and stuff. And I was like, are you shitting me? Like,
yeah.
How's that just sitting there?
I mean, you got to remember, America has liked to drink for a long damn time, and a lot of bottles have been produced and a lot of bottles have been sold, and a lot of people never got around to drinking those. So there's bottles everywhere, and I guess they're just going to keep emerging. Maybe not at liquor stores, but somewhere.
Yeah, I think that'll be the interesting thing to see how dusty hunting takes a different, I guess you'd say, path in regards to that. Because, yeah, I mean, that's usually what I used to go do all the time. Of course, when you're trying to go unicorn hunting, and when you do, and this is, by the way, this is like 2014 timeframe, and I do this, and you pull off of every single exit because you're like, well, I'm on the highway, I might as well stop at every single liquor store. And you'd go through and, yeah, you'd look for the regular stuff. And then you'd start searching through the very bottom shelf. But you didn't want to look at the first bottles because they don't take the bottles and put the old ones to the front, right? It's not like milk at the grocery store.
Yeah.
But instead, yeah, you're pulling all the way from the back and you're just trying to see, is there anything that might be a little gem that's kind of hidden that has been forgotten about? But it just goes back to the very top of the show. I can't believe people sat on inventory for 30, 40 years and just didn't even think about like putting it in a clearance bin.
Yeah. And I think some states don't even allow for clearance bins, you know, deep discounts on booze. And as we said, a lot of this alcohol has looked exactly the same for many years. Chartreuse, which is another big vintage collectible, it's looked virtually identical for 50 plus years. So you keep turning over who's running the shelves, running the registers at your store. And they would have to know how to read importing codes and whatnot to know, wow, we have a bottle of 1970s green chartreuse here. Instead, why not just push it all the way to the back, as you said, and hope someone buys it eventually.
I also want to kind of get your take on this because I just looked at the table of contents and they actually talk about a dusty mixologist. So there's a new bar that opened up here in Louisville. It's called Seven, and they specialize, of course, in different cocktails, but they actually have a dusty cocktail menu. And so you're talking upwards of probably $25 to $35 for a particular cocktail. And when I'm thinking of that, I'm kind of like, oh man, like I like my cocktails, but I don't think I've ever had a cocktail made with a dusty. I'd love to get your opinion on it to say like, A, because as you said, it's a non-renewable resource. And do you really think like a dusty can really basically like elevate a cocktail? Or do you think it's just kind of a, I don't know.
And do you need dusty cocktail ingredients to go with it? Luxardo's and...
I think it's both an interesting thing to drink. And yes, of course, it's a gimmick trying to part you of your money. But at the same time, I've had vintage martinis that are incredible, vintage Negronis. You need a all-alcohol cocktail. You can't have a vintage daiquiri. They're not going to pull lime juice from the 60s. You kind of need those very simple cocktails like Negronis and Manhattans or whatnot. You know, I think what happened is a lot of these early vintage bourbon buyers were getting bottles of Campari, bottles of sweet vermouth tossed in extra, bottles of gin. And there wasn't much of a market for them back then. So what to do with them? Well, no one's going to buy neat vintage gin for me. But if I turn it into a vintage Negroni, a vintage martini with this vintage vermouth and vintage Campari that also no one wants to buy individually, now I have something. And a few of those bars did emerge, most famously the Milk Room in Chicago, Cannon in Seattle, which I mentioned with the massive, massive menu of vintage. They always have a vintage cocktail menu that can be quite interesting. You know, it's a fun treat. Who was I talking to yesterday? Oh, I was talking to Eric Castro, who owns bars in San Diego. And just as kind of like a joke, he put a $700 Stitzelweller vintage old fashioned on the menu. Tony Hawk comes in with a buddy, buys a round, enjoys it so much, he bought a second round. So,
oh my gosh.
That was a quick $2,800 two rounds of old fashions. I mean, it's an exciting thing to have on the menu, even if people don't necessarily buy it all the time.
Yeah.
You just need to sell one.
That takes care of the paper that you have to go reprint all the time for the menus when they have to rotate.
Right, exactly.
Aaron, I've loved this discussion going over this. Is there anything else in the book that you kind of want to touch on or anything like that that we haven't given away that might entice some folks to go and pick up a copy?
Well, geez, I'm trying my hardest to tell all the great stories to sell.
Well, no, I mean, there really is. I really loved it because there's so much to that is enamored with just the dusty side. If people are brand new and you're getting into bourbon, I would say, as Aaron said, treat yourself to something. This is an opportunity. Like if you go to one of these iconic bars, just think about it. Actually, don't think about it. Toss down the $40 or $50 or whatever it is and try something vintage. And I would also encourage you to try the modern day version right next to it. Having J.W. Dant bottled and bond from pre-fire versus today and you have them side by side, world of difference.
Yeah.
And it really just helps you appreciate the idea of dusties and dusty hunting and the collecting side of things. And hopefully it doesn't take you to another mortgage payment from it as well.
Well, you don't need Tony Hawk money to try vintage spirits. Neat and Revival always have something interesting for 10 or 15 bucks. Pre-fire Heaven Hill, I think, is a great way to get into vintage. And it's usually pretty affordable to have a glass or two. Both Owen and Brad usually have a special on something. So you don't need to have that $50 ounce pour of something to start dipping your toes into vintage bourbon.
Yeah. No, I love it.
That Pre-Fire Heaven Hill has to be one of the most widely available.
Yeah.
Because they just, not only was there Heaven Hill, but they had so many
labels,
brands that they were sourcing whiskey to and labels and whatnot. So,
yeah, stuff we haven't heard of today. Available. Anderson Club, Virgin Bourbon. If it looks like the Evan Williams bottle, it's Pre-Fire Heaven Hill usually.
There you go. There's your decoder ring. Well, Aaron, like I said, it was fun to have you back on the show and be able to talk about it. Give one last plug for the book, where people can learn more about it, where they can learn more about you, and where can they buy it?
Yeah, Dusty Booze in Search of Vintage Spirits, out March 5th. I don't know if this is airing before then, hopefully. Any place you can buy a book, it'll be there.
Awesome, man. Thank you again for putting out another great piece of art and piece of work for us to all enjoy. I've always been a fan of what you've been able to do, your articles on VinePair, your articles on Forbes, you know, just everywhere. I really appreciate what you do for the category and being able to get really in depth and have captivating stories that really help take our fascination or maybe, I don't know, obsession with all this. But you put it in such an eloquent way that we can show our wives and be like, see, we're not alone here.
Well, that's nice. I need to show my wife something so she knows she's not alone.
Well, very cool. So make sure you go out, get yourself a copy of Dusty Booze, and like I said, take the opportunity to go ahead and buy yourself a drink, put it on Ryan's credit card and his tab when you go there too.
Yeah, sounds good.
That's right.
Yeah. But with that, like I said, follow Aaron, follow Bourbon Pursuit wherever you get your podcasts, follow us as well on all the social media channels. But with that, everybody, cheers. We'll see you next time.